I hope you all enjoyed this wonderful film. And I do have a lot of questions for you, and I think you also have some things to discuss. Let's start with you, Van. You worked for many years on this project. Can you tell us a little bit about the start of the project and your cooperation with the other director, Mila?
This project actually started when we were approached by Doc Channel, and they wanted us to do some kind of film about kind of crazy and wacky scientists. And so we did get the crazy and wacky scientists, but I think we pivoted it to something we thought was a little bit more serious and perhaps more interesting for an educated audience or for an audience that wants to learn significant things. And so we started, we really got inspired when we started looking into this. There's a New Yorker article, which I encourage everybody to read, that came out about four years ago, which kind of, in some ways, served as the jumping off point for this film, for the blueprint of this film. The reporter of that article actually went to Eater and kind of uncovered a lot of the interesting characters and things happening in that place as we did.
Well, thank you. And was it difficult to get entrance to Eater?
Absolutely not. It was. They were super inviting. They were almost at that point 4 years ago, begging for people to come visit them and talk to the scientists and stuff. And it blew our minds that really at that point in time, very few people had any. This wasn't on the radar of almost anybody, and we couldn't believe it. Everybody knew about CERN. Everybody knew what was happening there. And it's kind of ironic because that's a very abstract project with you know, difficult applications for humanity. It's really fascinating, but this project is something that's really geared towards solving a huge problem, and nobody knew about it. So we kind of thought we hit a little bit of pay dirt, and we were excited. But they invited us in and gave us pretty much full access, and were very, very, very candid with us. So I really appreciate the organization for doing that.
And for how many years did you work on the project?
It was about 4 years. The process was about four years long. Yeah.
And you traveled a lot.
Well, we did a couple spins around the world. There's certain parts that didn't. As was mentioned in the film, Eater has about 37 countries participating, and so we did go to other places. But in order to keep the film succinct and to the point, we had to cut out some places. So we spent a lot of time in Japan, and unfortunately, that didn't get in there. And some other installations in the U.S. But we did go around a lot.
You look proud to.
I think it's nice then when you can. Well, I'm really happy that all you guys are here. So thank you very much for coming here. This is fabulous. It's a fabulous event, and I wish that everywhere in the world had relatively big audiences like this to watch this kind of film. But I'm happy that something like this can be shared with people, and we can learn together. It's important.
Thank you. Well, Marco, I'm also proud that you will be here. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and how you started? Because you are working at ITER, but how it starts for you?
Okay. Well, I studied physics in Utrecht, specialized in the science, the physics of fusion, and then did my PhD also on a very experimental physics-oriented topic, the turbulent transport that we have in fusion fuel. And then after that, I more and more developed into operational, managerial, and also engineering roles, which, frankly, I like better.
And you're working at DIFR, and I know there are some more people here from DIFR. What's DIFR doing in this project?
DIFR is the Dutch institute that is for 50% doing the nuclear fusion research in its mission. So we have two research lines. One is on development of so-called solar fuels, and the other line is the fusion. I'm head of the fusion research line.
And what's the role of the Netherlands in this project? Can you explain that a bit?
We have three main scientific topics. The first one is the development of really high fidelity instruments for plasma heating and for observation of the plasma. And then we have a line where we really try to control the fusion fuel, the stability and the performance of it. And the third one is that we're very much interested in the interaction of the fuel with the solid materials. We have to develop special materials to deal with the intense fluxes that we're facing. And we can even go a bit wild if you want, mad scientist, here you go. We are even considering to build a reactor wall that is based on liquid metals. So that's the sort of stuff we do.
I do have a question for you, Fan. You were working for 4 years on this project. I'm from the age that we were protesting against nuclear energy. Did you ever have fear in this project?
Well, no, actually, nuclear fusion is an extremely, extremely, extremely safe process. There's no real possible way. I mean, Marco should speak to us, but I think inside the tokamak, when it's running, the plasma will actually be about under a gram of fuel or something, like some very small amount of matter in the tokamak. And I mean, as soon as you lose it, the plasma just dissipates. It's not something that can explode like a nuclear reactor or something like that. So I was never scared about being around these installations. And generally, that's one of the big pluses of this technology. When it becomes a reality, is that it's extremely safe and that there's very little waste. There's the machine itself will become radiated, and something will have to be done with that material. But it's not nearly the level of the kind of the fuels that come out of traditional nuclear fission.
And after 4 years of working on the project, did it change your own life?
Yeah, I think it changed. I changed a big thing for me because I believe a lot in I believe a lot in technology, and this made me believe more in technology to see all the kind of all the milestones you guys are making, and all the technological and scientific problems that you guys have solved. And when I see what the biggest thing standing in front of us solving these big problems is, a lot of it's like bureaucratic and planning issues. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. That happens a lot, but I think it's something that we have to put attention to. And I think probably one of the biggest benefits of ITER isn't just the scientific aspect and the technological aspect, is the fact that we've actually taken together all these people, and we're all these different countries and all these different cultures, and we're actually achieving something at this level. And for the world to go forward and for us to continue to tackle these problems, especially climate change, it's going to take exactly this kind of way to do it. So this is kind of almost a prototype for further projects and a lot of things that we have to do going forward. So of course it's going to be really difficult at this point. These coming together, these bureaucracy, all these things are really difficult, but solving those are just as important as solving some of these more technical problems as well.
What strikes me in this film is the belief from people in a better world and all the enthusiasm and passion. Is that something that you recognize in your work?
Yes, very much so. This was really, I want to compliment you guys because I know the projects very well. I know very many of the individuals that were on the show, and you managed to really bring them to life as they are. Mark Henderson, of course, we see a lot. Mark and I were in a project together. Also, the other Dutch guys that are the different guys that are here. In fact, we were in competition. The Dutch had a design for a component, and the Swiss had a design for that component, and we were fighting. Who's going to get the design? In the end, the Swiss design was winning, and since then we work very well together. But it's really like what you see.
Yeah. Well, that was new for me. Actually, the whole project was new. And I don't understand why we guys in Holland, why don't we know such a little thing about diffusion?
Oh, it's very simple. If you are looking at it from a perspective as a journalist, you're interested in novelty. And what we're doing here is slow. So if a journalist comes a year later, we can't show a lot of novelty. If you look at the project plan, you see these very big components, very big. The coil you saw, this D-shaped coil that they were winding in Italy, weighs more than an A380, this big Airbus. And they're going to make 20 of them. And you know, you do one coil. No journalist gives a toss, to be honest, because it's just a boring thing. But from a technological perspective, it's big impact. So it's very difficult for us if you compare what we are trying to achieve, to bring that out to journalists in comparison to CERN, where they do very fundamental stuff, or NASA. NASA has very exciting, fantastic science, and the novelty is greater.
Yeah, I do understand that. I also like the comparison with the cathedral that's built, that some people who start it will never see the end of the project, and maybe it's the same with this.
Yeah, I will be there with Meryl later, but...
Yeah, you are. But there were some people in the film...
Who were.
Great. Yeah.
Well, the big names of the first hour... Fantastic scientists from the U.S. and from Europe, and from Russia, they have passed away.
That's
where we are.
And I think something that Mark mentioned in the film was that the thing about novelty. I think the world's only really going to notice when this machine or a machine like it is actually making energy, and until then, everybody thinks it's a failure or an ongoing failure. And what they don't know is that there's all these incremental things that have been happening over the last 30 years. And the progress in fusion, basically the confinement time, the temperature, the stability of these plasmas has been getting better and better and better. And Mark often claims that if you plot the kind of the progress that they've made in those terms against, let's say, the speed of the development of microprocessors, fusion is actually ahead, even though it's like... He gets a pittance of the funding of that technology, for instance. So these guys are really doing amazing work, and they've got their heads down, and they're just—it's really phenomenal what they're doing. But because they can't, you know, turn on a light bulb yet, everybody's like, "Oh, it's not working." But it's like what he said with the airplane. If you know, we didn't say flight didn't work because we weren't moving 100 people across the Atlantic, but it is working.
So that. In fact, is a very genuine comparison. The fusion figure of merit is going faster than Moore's law, and you can just measure it. Every year, we are better at identifying instabilities in the plasma, effectively aiming at them and killing them, and get a better performance in the plasma, and that drives up the confinement time. So we're doing it.
And if you take in consideration how many money is involved and how many years we have to work, I have the question, isn't it better to put our money in the solar and in the wind energy? Or what's your opinion about this?
Well, I'm a very big fan of renewables. So let it be very clear. At this point... Renewables are penetrating the energy market, and that is good. So let's do that. Having said that, when you look at energy consumption, you have three very distinct segments. First is what we call the built environment, let's say houses, personal use of electricity, heating. For that, the renewables most likely are going to be quite okay. Then you have long-distance transport. For this, you need very concentrated energy carriers. Here, the renewables are problematic. And then finally, you have a very big industry where you need not only the energy, but you also need very high temperature heat for example, in the chemical industry or in the metal, there the renewables are never going to make it. So I'm not poo-pooing renewables. I'm just saying we need to look at the energy transition not as a one. There's no silver bullet.
Solution,
yeah. We have to penetrate the renewables. Then we have to come up with the second part, where we can develop these, let's say, environmentally friendly ways of these high energy density carriers. And then finally, we need to think of reactors that drive not only the energy but also the high temperature heat fluxes. And fusion could do that. So on the long term, there was a very specific niche for this program.
I really agree.
Maybe too technical, I'm sorry, but I'm a bit of a nerd.
It's very good explained, yeah. Yeah, there are some questions, of course, yeah. Is there a mic available? Because then we can hear the...
Thank you so much for this film. I've been wanting to know more about fusion, and I learned a lot. But I'm just curious, has anyone, scientists I'm sure have thought, maybe you can give a personal perspective about free direct energy as a potential path as well. Tesla's free direct energy. How come that has not had this worldwide push that fusion has? What was the early thinking process that, let's go with fusion, no free direct energy path?
I'm a bit puzzled.
What do you mean with free energy? Maybe you can explain that then.
Well, the military's been using it for a long time now. I'm no scientist, believe me, but free direct energy was what Tesla used, and they took it away from him, the people who were controlling him, and so it hasn't been introduced into the general community, but the military has been using free direct energy. The U.S. military, at least, has been using free direct energy. I'm sure you've heard of it.
But
do you mean solar?
No. I think if it comes from Tesla, it must be some sort of electromagnetic wave that they apply. But the electromagnetic wave then has to be generated, and typically this goes at a very low conversion. So I'm a bit puzzled. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Okay, I thought it was known.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I know other scientists have been using it as well, but it gets shut down really quick. So,
mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks.
Is there another question in the audience? Yeah, of course.
Hi.
It works.
Well,
you can.
I have a question because I feel there's a problem of how you communicate these projects. So, as a scientist, as a person that is actually communicating these, how do you like? Which do you think has been the problem that people has actually not seen the progress, and it's not really interested in it, probably, but I guess we cannot just assume that people is not interested. Why people doesn't know about this?
You told it before. Yeah.
For
both, from the perspective of both of you.
Well, this is very personal perspective. I'm not sure if I'm right. But I think that a lot of the fusion science is very intricate. It's following the evolution of different distributions of fields, different, so particle, temperature, current density, and how they interact together. And this is very interesting, very beautiful science, but it's also very difficult to explain. There are other projects that are within fusion that have a very technological orientation, and I think that one way of bringing fusion forward is to focus on the evolution of those technological projects. And I think a lot of science journalists are not so much interested in that, but I think there's a lot of wealth and a lot of results that can be reported in that segment. So that would be my first shot at it. For example, we have here guys who are working on the development of robotic systems for the reactor maintenance. And here you do see quick progress. And then you see, for example, that when they develop those robotic technologies, it can also be applied in medical care. And then if you develop it in medical care, suddenly, hey, you know, we can feed that back into the fusion program and we can apply it somewhere else. So you really see this myriad of opportunities that comes with the technological development, and that is, I think, as exciting and very relevant.
And I also think that the media could be more responsible and with this kind of thing and try to put a little bit more effort and try to stoke a little bit more interest in these kind of things. They're one of our best moments after this film was when we were in Warsaw in Poland, and a 10-year-old boy ran up to us and he said, "We saw your movie yesterday, and I got it all, and I'm so excited about fusion." And that was really probably the most touching moment after making this film, because that's exactly what we want to do. We want kids, we want people to get excited about these things, and we want these scientists, they're really the heroes of our civilization.
Give me a beer, but
no, but everything that we've achieved as a people on this planet has been because of people like these scientists that put their head down and spend the long hours, and often in their lifetime they just do this little tiny granular thing, but all together it gives us the kind of quality life we've had these days. And I think we have to put them on a higher pedestal, and we have to show them, and we have to show them to our children on an equal footing to football players, or on an equal footing to you know, the Kardashians or whatever.
That would be funny.
But you did a very good job, because there is humor in it. We can laugh. There are beautiful animations. It's very good shot. Yeah, thank you. Are there more questions? Yeah.
This early efforts of the Russians with that, I'm not remember the name now. But what was it aimed at? What wanted they in those years to achieve? Because now we are very obsessed with getting alternative energy. But in those days, what in the early days, what they were aiming at?
Well, they were aiming at energy production. You must be aware that the leading scientist who was pulled into the project was, in fact, the big Sakharov, who was involved in the development of the hydrogen bomb and the fission bomb in the Soviet Union. So he was the top-notch guy in their weapon program. And they pulled him, and they said, okay, try this concept and try to make a reactor. And it was really, really a phenomenal success. They really jumped in temperatures and densities within almost three or four orders better than what the Americans were doing at that time. It's really, you know, this is a very cool story. We had in England a very old colleague who was working in a so-called Thomson scattering, which is a method to measure the temperature in plasmas. And he was starting as a master student in Aldermaston, where the Brits have their weapon program. And he was trained to do Thomson scattering for testing the performance of the UK weapon program. And they needed to find somebody to check whether the Russians really had those temperatures they were claiming, because the Russians couldn't measure it. They could model it, and they could infer from the models, but they couldn't measure it. So they took the youngest guy, because he didn't have the experience, and they sent him on a plane to Russia, told him, don't speak on the phone about anything, because you will be tapped, and measure shouldn't be rude, but measure the plasma. And in fact, he was then there and measured that they went over 10 million degrees with a very small device. And that was the breakthrough. Then people realized this is working.
And I think something that's interesting to note also with the Russian story and also with the American story, both those main scientists, Sakharov and Lyman Spitzer, they were both inspired by basically by frauds almost. Well, definitely Lyman Spitzer, but also the guy that inspired Sakharov was a soldier out in an outpost in the middle of nowhere, and he didn't really, he understood something about physics, but his original idea wasn't very realistic at all, but it did inspire the idea in Sakharov's head about how to develop it. And so there's often an interesting parallel between real science and the kind of flights of fancy that inspire that science. So once again, I think it's worth it to inspire kids and to inspire everybody just to get ideas going, because it's not always a critically great scientific idea that is there at the nascence. It's often a crazy idea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
There are more questions.
I hope
here at the front. The Willy Wortel. Yeah.
Are you asking me? First and foremost, general fusion is, I think, really performing at a professional level. I'm not sure whether they will produce what they want to produce. It's research, so we can't be sure. But they really have a professional team, and they go for it. And they also have a lot of investing money flowing in. The other one, I would love to have met a party and drink wine with him, you know. But the idea that you use instabilities to get to a better possible performance and then hoping to achieve a billion degrees, I mean, that is ambitious. Let me put it like that.
I have kind of the same kind of question, actually. But I was also wondering if you guys collaborate with those research groups, the smaller research groups that we saw there, and are they... Well, bringing you into new ideas and putting you on new paths in a way.
This is of course this will depend from fusion lab to fusion lab. Our policy is that we work in principle with anybody who is genuine. There are a few, and I'm not going to name any names, but there are a few people that I would qualify as crooks, and we simply should not be rude. But we don't work with them. But for example, with General Fusion, we work. And there are a lot of topics that are, although the method is very different, are very similar. For example, the idea of working with a liquid metal that they pump around to build this confining metal fluid, we work with liquid metals as a concept for a reactor wall. So there's a direct link in the MHD stability and the interaction of the liquid metal with the other materials, and there could be corrosive effects. So yes, we work together, and we know each other, and we drink beer together. It's all cool.
That's good. Yeah, and all in transparency. Yeah.
Sometimes there are commercial problems, and then it's not so easy. But in principle, yes.
But the work Bernard did was great to bring the project on a higher level.
Apart from the science and technology that is very difficult, a very important issue with the whole ITER system was that the governance was very complicated.
Yeah.
So you have ITER, where they try to integrate the whole system, and then you have a number of so-called domestic agencies, and those domestic agencies deal with industry. So we have, for example, in Barcelona, the European domestic agency, and they deal with big companies like Airbus or Asystem or whatever. Now, this is a big problem, because if you work on a system where everything is new, you try to manage according to the tolerance and the performance of the whole system.
Yeah.
If at some point a producer of a subsystem doesn't meet its specs, you need to be in a position to say, but then those other subsystems need to be cranked up so that the whole system can work according to performance. Now, if you have the governance set up as they did, it's very difficult to manage that whole chain.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what Bernard Bigot was fighting for, and he seems to achieve it. So he literally improved the governance, and with that, the technology becomes simpler. And this is difficult to
manage.
Well, it's difficult to understand how vital this is if you don't work in high tech yourself. But this is the key.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good, good.
Last
question?
Sure.
Yeah, okay, because we are running out of time. Maybe over there?
So, hopefully a quick question. So, we've seen ITER and a couple smaller projects. Is there something that you would put your money on next to ITER?
We in our institute work for the Tokamak line and the Stellarator line. So we are involved in both lines. And we are simply interested to see which one is best. For ITER, I think this is something that needs to be explained. Whether you believe that the Tokamak is going to be the reactor or not is maybe not so important. The key thing is that the tokamak is the quickest route to make a burning plasma. That is a plasma that is dominated by the fusion reaction itself. And ITER is still an experiment. And the main purpose of ITER is to study the burning plasma and its dynamic behavior. So ITER is the best way to do that. And once you understand that, you can even think of other reactor concepts like the Stellarator or others.
And just to add to that, ITER will be much more complicated than an eventual power plant, because ITER is just full with all these thermometers and sensors and all these ways to essentially it's a learning machine. It's not really intended to actually build power for anything like that. So in many ways, it's actually more complicated than the machine that might come after it. But in the meantime, it has to be that complicated so these guys can get their answers.
True.
Yeah, I'm very sorry, but I think we have to finish, and those guys will drink something at the bar, so if you have more questions, ask them. I want to thank you for the beautiful film.
Thank you for having us.
And I hope a lot of filmmakers will follow your example, and I will thank you for your great explanation and your passion. Yeah.
Whoa. Thanks to the Canadian Embassy for having us.
Thank you. Let's have a drink.